Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm very good. This meeting is being recorded.
Yes. Anything you say can will be used against you.
Yes. Right. I did a thing with Bob Picardo, Joe. That's the last time we worked together with Bob Picardo and I. We did a thing called Extra School, learning how to be an extra. You know, like when you talk, you don't talk. Stuff like that. It's great.
Exactly.
Bruce and Bob worked together in the Amazing Stories episode that I directed called Boo. Eddie Bracken and Evelyn Keyes, and
Scarlett O'Hara's other sister,
right, who was really great. And at one point she had to have this sort of zombie makeup on, so it was like they just put white stuff all over her face. She looked 14. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, she must have been in her 70s.
Oh yes.
Well, I guess should we do it?
Go for it.
Joe and I are a bit rusty. We've been off for when's the last time we did it? It's been like a week.
Yeah.
It was like a year.
Hard to believe we can function without doing this.
I know. I've had to talk about movies with friends. It's driving me crazy. This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
Childhood, sir.
I did.
Yes, you did. When I was a kid, Willard was the movie to see.
Oh, yeah.
By which you measured your intestinal fortitude, and just finding an adult who would take you to that thing. I'm so excited to have.
I thought he was going to say Fortune in Men's Eyes.
You know, it was interesting. No. Oh, can I get to talk to?
Oh no, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Yes, no, they. Yes, please do. Please say something.
You know who else was a fan when I worked with was Stephen King, and I didn't know that at the time. But I was doing a thing called Kingdom Hospital TV series that we worked on
that's
together.
Right, remake of the Lars von Trier
up in Vancouver, and he said. What was that you used to say? I used to hate myself, but I like myself now. He had me standing in the rain and repeating that over and over, like 12 till 3 in the morning. I don't know if they ever used it, but it was great. I used to hate myself, but I like myself now.
That's fantastic.
Are you Are you one of those actors who doesn't like to watch himself and doesn't?
Yes, unfortunately, I am. Yeah, I didn't used to be that way. I used to think I could fix things that I couldn't fix after they were done and already released. But it was always, oh, geez, that's a way. And I think about it driving home in the car.
So, are there classics of yours that you actually haven't watched?
Oh, I don't know. Well, I watch them eventually. You know, I guess the last 10, 15 years, I haven't done any classics in the last 15 years, I don't think. But yeah, a couple of things. I just recently watched Shortcuts because on Altman's film.
And fantastic movie, yeah.
Really liked what he did. I love the ensemble.
Yeah.
Everybody. He had 8 people mic'd at the same time. All overlapping and talking each other, which is something he got fired for working at Warner Brothers. They gave him his box, a cardboard box outside the door. They wouldn't even let him back in because of all the overlapping dialogue he was doing on Combat or something.
The price of being ahead of your time, I guess. Well, he's also, Shortcuts. And you were, was it Golden Globe for best ensemble acting, I think. And
then, yes, absolutely. Yeah,
you also won one for A Longtime Companion, which you also got nominated for an Oscar for. I'm telling you, I'll tell our audience. He's in a ton of Broadway. He's in the great, great Frank Perry movie last summer. Short Eyes, A Longtime Companion, Shortcuts, Willard, of course, currently seen in The Manor. And going to be in the upcoming season of Ozark, and a movie, and I'm going to force you to do something. I don't think I've ever done anybody like this before, because I've heard this story and it's great. And I just want to hear it again so that our listeners can, but I went to see Ozana's Raid, which is a movie I love, love, love at the New Beverly a while ago. It has to have been before quarantine. So whenever that was, and you were there you had the best Burt Lancaster story. About him forgetting your name later, that I'm hoping you can recreate for us.
Oh, I've got a lot of great Burt Lancaster.
Oh, I'm sure, but this one, like, I had the whole audience just in tears. It was so lovely.
Oh yes, yeah. I was doing The Little Foxes with Harris Yulin, playing my father, and he said Burt's out there tonight. You know, but he doesn't want to come backstage, and so I didn't. By the time I got out there, he left. And I said, "Well, what happened? You know, we worked together for 4 or 5 months on this film." He says, "Oh, he said, oh yeah, he said he remembered you. He said you were." He says, "Bruce Williamson. He's a wonderful actor." And I used to think, "Fuck that," but now I understand, because I can't remember anybody's name that I worked with. I'm thinking Henry, what was it? Oh, Fonda. Yeah, that's I had a daughter, Jane, yeah. So I understand now, but I have a better Burt Lancaster.
Oh, but I thought you left out the best part, or maybe there was a follow-up where you ran into him and he still couldn't remember your name, but where he remembered your rank.
Oh, lieutenant. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He remembered me as the character I played.
Right.
And lieutenant. And the first time we were working together, we were out on horseback in a two-shot. And it was the first day, and we were losing the light. And Aldrich has got 50 cavalry and the painted desert behind us, and he's got to get this shot in the next 2 minutes. And Bert and I are on horseback, and the dialogue is, "Well, you got to ride a horse till it drops dead on you. If you're an Apache, then you'll cut a piece off, eat, steal another. You can't better that, Lieutenant." And I'm saying, "Well, I hate to think of people in jeopardy." And he says, "Well, it's best not to." And he rides out of the shot. So we're the two of us are on the horseback, and he's standing there. "So you're a student at NYU?" "Yes, I went to I went to NYU School of Hard Knocks up in Hell's Kitchen there," and he started to inch his horseback. So if you're two actors and one inches his horseback, you know, he's the one that the other one's got to take a look at it. And we're just doing a two-shot. So he starts inching his horseback. So I said, "Yeah," he says, "Oh, yes. And you live where?" I said, "Oh, 72nd on the park there." He's, "Oh, you know that tall building there on the park, 72nd? Shelley Winters lives there. You ever seen her when she was young? Oh, hell of a broad. Yeah, we almost had a kid in 56. He's inching his horse back, and he looks over, and I just instinctively, I started to move my horse back. You know. He turns around, he says, "This is the most beautiful savanna, this country out here, isn't it? The young lieutenant is not as innocent as he seems, are you, you little son of a bitch?" and then Aldrich says, "What the hell are you two guys? You're off your marks. Get on your marks there. We're losing the light." So that was my first shooting with Bert, who I adored and who gave me some great advice later on.
Did he continue to upstage you, or did you?
Oh, every chance he got, but he didn't have to. You know, I thought I was, I'm acting him off this. I'm acting storms around him. And then I unfortunately would watch The Rushes when I was younger, and I'd see, and it would be like this little whippet bouncing around a bulldog, you know. I'm acting. He's, yes, son, you're acting. That's good. But nobody's watching. They're watching me. Because I just stand here and I'm the Rock of Gibraltar.
That's right. I'm Burt Lancaster. God, yeah. That's hilarious. Well, thank you. And we're very excited to have you here. And
thank you.
Love to talk to you about kind of the movies that inspired you over the years.
Great.
What I know, yeah, I mean, I gather, although you never know for sure, according to Wikipedia, you stumbled into acting accidentally. So I don't know if...
I was up at Penn State University as an art major. I started, I started as an art major in school. I thought that's what I wanted to be. And then my parents made me get a BA. So I had an extra course and I took, and it was appreciation of theater. And I was walking along with a friend one day up at Penn State, and there was an audition. So I walked in. He said, "Go ahead, I'll challenge her." She did. I'm sorry. So it was "Come Back, Little Sheba," and it was just for the, a small part in it. And I got up there and I was terrified, and I didn't get the part. But man, wow! Anything that scares me that much must be kind of interesting. And all of those great lines you get to say, I can't paint my way into meeting girls. But if I had a good line, So anyway,
a big movie person beforehand? Do you like film?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yep. I loved the films, and especially the films that I would see starting at Penn State. There was a theater called 12 Trees, which was where I got involved in a lot of the foreign films and the great performances they had there. And that really altered and changed my perceptions on a lot of things.
That was fantastic. Well, yeah. So I want to hear about some of the movies you loved when you were.
Okay. Well, I could only get 11. I mean, I couldn't get rid of one of them. But
okay.
Anyway, but the first.
Fine. We'll send it to you. You have 6 weeks to pay it. And
all right. That's pretty good. Can you take a check?
Sure.
Okay. first was not a movie. It was a series. The TV series was Flash Gordon, which were the serials, The Mongo and Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars. Wasn't a big fan of Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe because they looked like Robin Hood costumes by then. And I guess I was not as fooled as I was when I was younger, but I kept trying to organize the neighborhood into, Ming the Merciless was my best friend. And of course I was Flash and whoa. So that was my first.
Did you see those? Because those were Saturday morning serials first.
Saturday morning serials, but then they got them on television.
Right.
And, at first television with three channels, and you'd watch The Indian from 9 till 9 o'clock when something had come on. The Test Pattern.
That's right. Yeah, I was going to say we had to explain to some of our audience that used to be.
It used to be an Indian, not a Native American.
Oh, that's right. But yeah, your television.
The fact that there used to be television that didn't have anything on it.
Yes.
There was nothing on it. And then at midnight, they'd play the Star Spangled Banner and you'd just watch.
Yeah, like midnight. And then right. All night long, if you turn the TV at 3 a.m., there would be this.
Snow.
Yeah, snow. Yeah. And then there'd be that picture. Of the stuff. Yep.
And then Modern Farmer would come on in the morning.
Yes.
Before my time.
Or Dave Garraway.
Yeah.
Or Kukla Fan and Ollie.
Or if it was Sunday, Lamp Unto My Feet.
Anyway, I was
there. You have a guy, by the way, who listens to all of these and cites every TV show, movie, whatever that's referenced in this thing. And he's got to find links for them for our website. And I think I can't wait for him to find out about Lamp Unto My Feet. That's going to be fun. Sorry, Alex.
Who was Captain Kangaroo before he was Captain Kangaroo?
Oh, Captain K. Yes, I remember him.
He was
Keishan, War Hero.
That's right.
Yes, he was, even before that, before he worked on Howdy Doody as Clarabel, the clown. Right. Okay, so the second one I have was a movie. And it was the first movie that I remember seeing my father. My mother divorced when I was three, and my father used to get me for weekends, and the first thing he'd do would be to take me to the same movie, which was playing for a year, and that was King Solomon's Mines.
Oh, wow.
And that had the greatest impact on me as a kid. You know, I used to be on the playground, and I'd want to say something important to a girl, and I'd say, "Don't sit there, ants. In the jungle, it's eat or be eaten."
That's fantastic. And you're from Philadelphia too, Carina,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
Well, that's amazing, because you just described my childhood in Philadelphia.
Oh,
a few years later.
Well, then
yes.
You remember Chief Halftown.
Oh my God! Yeah,
I do. How old was Chief Halftown? Because in New Jersey, we could actually get a shadowy version of Channel 6, which was Philadelphia, and they had all the best cartoons.
And
watch that.
Roland was, before he became Zachary and moved to New York, was Roland, and showed all the horror movies at 11 o'clock on Friday night and Saturday. But Chief Halftown.
That was before my time, but I do remember Chief Halftown.
Do you?
That's
do you
crazy,
remember what he used to say?
Nice.
He used to say, "Sesaway," which meant roll the cartoons.
Fantastic.
Do you remember Sally Starr?
Sally Starr with the guns, yes.
Wait, are we the same age, or did she just ran forever, right? Is that
Sally Starr was on for a long time. I always thought that she had been a stripper, but I don't know that was true.
She
had a show. It was on for a long time.
It was on forever, yeah.
All those six shooters.
Yep.
Next movie. God.
So yeah, King Solomon's Mine. So wait, so how many times? Because my dad would do that too. He would take me to the same movie over and over again.
Well, it played for years, and it was what my father would do. It was either King Solomon's Mines or The Zoo.
Okay.
So that was it. Occasionally Snow White or something, but I really love King Solomon's Mines. I was always, you know, a woman on safari, don't be ridiculous. I wouldn't take a woman on safari for £1,000. What about 3,000? We leave tomorrow.
That's fantastic. Actually, I got to say, Willard is one of those movies, by the way, that my old man took me to more than once inappropriately. But enough about my trauma, sir. What's next? What's next?
Next would be a movie I saw with my older stepbrother when we went to Minnesota. I'd spend times in Minnesota. We walked into this movie not knowing what it was about, but it was entitled Them. Them scared the bejesus right out of me. You know,
me too.
Came home with wet shorts from Them. Especially that little girl walking through the desert with the doll with the broken head. Them. Oh. That did it for me when I was young. That was my first great horror movie.
Giant ants.
Giant ants.
Yeah. And am I wrong, Joe? I feel like I said this once before and you correct me. Isn't that the one that Clint Eastwood plays one of the fighter pilots in?
No, that's Tarantula.
Tarantula.
That's a movie that wouldn't have been made if it wasn't for them.
That was James Arness. I think Fess Parker was in it.
That's the movie where Walt Disney found Fess Parker for Davy Crockett.
Yeah. See, there you go.
The man who would know.
That's correct. Yes.
Oh, it's a seminal movie for me. I mean,
can you go back to the way you saw it when you were a kid? Because I'm almost fascinated. I'm almost struggling to do this myself. Were you all in, or was it kind of clear that it was all fake?
Oh, first of all, I was young, so it wasn't a question of whether it was fake or not, because you didn't know what it was that was killing all these people, that left the old guy with his face all chewed up and sugar all around him in the basement. And then they leave the cop alone there on the hill. And then he hears this. That's what scared me. By the time they got to, you know, burning them out and, you know, with the grabbing James Whitmore with the claws and everything, you were in it. You were you were with the thing. You were along with the army. You were fighting the monsters with the army. But the first half of The Unknown is what really you know, scared me to death.
Fantastic. Were you, did that sort of turn you into a big horror guy?
Well, yeah, I always liked horror films. I mean, I was always, I'll get to a couple later, but you want me to go to those, or do you want me to?
No, just do it whatever order you want.
Yeah.
I was trying to think the next thing that really started me as a kid was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Oh.
And that just suddenly, there was a whole world. I saved all my quarters and nickels up to try to buy scuba equipment because I wanted to go. And I live in Pennsylvania. There's nothing but the, you know, the rock quarries and stuff. Mm-hmm. You can go down and see a muddy truck at, you know, 75 feet or so. There's a steam shovel. But at the time, you know, seeing 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea really, really, I was so amazed at what could be done in a movie and what was spectacular. In fact, I even have a model of the Nautilus, which I learned how to draw as a kid, you know, making it and the glowing lights that comes through. And I got to meet Richard Fleischer years later, and he signed a DVD for me, and that was really exciting. But it fueled my interest in underwater diving and stuff, which continued all the way through high school. I thought I was wanting to be a marine biologist. And what I didn't realize is what I really wanted to be was like Mike Nelson in Sea Hunt and have adventures.
Yes.
So that's what happened. I got into the Mike Nelson School of Diving.
Did you learn to scuba dive?
Yes, I did.
I did.
I haven't lately, but I blew my eardrum out a little bit doing a dive. But I did go on one of the 12 most best dives in the world, which was in Fiji in a place called Taviuni. And you go along and you go through a blowhole and come out on the continental shelf, and the current carries you along for a mile. You can only do it once a month. You go in a group of 12 and you're all sort of tied together. And then you go back up another blowhole, and you hang out there till your equilibrium comes back, you know. So that was great. Okay. So I had a great adventure with that. And I finally got to live my dream of all time, and that was snorkeling with Lloyd Bridges.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. I think
one of the best dives in the world was McGlinchey's in Philadelphia, but it's not there anymore.
Hey, Doug. Yes.
Well, you haven't been back to Philadelphia.
They were there for a long time, though.
I can a lot of that. Dives there now.
Fantastic. That's why. That's sort of like, I guess that would be like me getting to, you know, finally fight crime with Adam West. I think that right. would be about yes. the.
You don't really have to do it. You just get into a business where you can play at it and get to
right. do all that. Wow, that's great. I love that. Well, give us another one.
Number five, Spartacus.
Number five. Are we on to five? Holy cow. Spartacus.
Spartacus, yes.
Yes.
I'm Spartacus.
I want to know where the wind comes from. I'd rather be a free slave among you than the richest slave in Rome. And that was, I used to spend my summers at Wildwood, New Jersey.
Yes.
With a friend named Billy Romig. And we used to, you know, play Spartacus and stuff all the time. And it carried me all the way into junior high when we would, you know, get trash can lids and fight for the damsels in distress out at the industrial sites. At which point the police had would capture all the girls sitting on the cars and come on the bullhorn and said, "This is Sergeant Rutgers. We have all the damsels in distress. So you, Romans, might as well go home or come in."
You saw that in the theater, I assume, right?
Yes.
First time? Yeah. And was that just overwhelming? Was it like?
Theater was overwhelming. The first play I saw was in Philadelphia, and that was My Fair Lady. Mm. I saw The Road Company of My Fair Lady. My mother actually was a secretary. She was a single mom working in Philadelphia. She'd go into Philadelphia every day. I was at Drexel Hill. And I'd go to school and she'd go to work. She worked for Grace Kelly's father, John B. Kelly. Okay. And so she'd get these free tickets, and her friend ended up being dates with Dane Clark and Don, I forget his name, directed,
Don Taylor?
Huh? Don Taylor? Yes, it was. It was Don Taylor. So when I came to town, my mother said, she didn't like Don Taylor. She thought he was kind of phony, but she really loved Dane Clark, and she thought he was great, and she was sorry he wasn't her date. And I came to town and I auditioned for Don Taylor for a movie. And I walked out the door and I said, anyway, Dad, it's glad to meet you. And he just left. And I ran into Dane Clark at a dental's office one time. And I pulled the same thing on him. I said, Mr. Clark, it's nice to finally meet you, Dad. And he looked at me and said, I wish so much it were true. And my mother was right about those guys.
Wow. Do you remember because you're still a kid, right? When Spartacus came out. Were you just overwhelmed? Was it?
I was a wonderful story. Yep. I mean, what was great about it is I saw Ben-Hur Ben-Hur was great spectacle and all, but Spartacus had a story and you characters you cared about, you know. Even Tony Curtis, I am a singer of songs, you know, you cared about all these people and Gene Simmons. Oh man.
Oh yeah.
Gene Simmons. I got in trouble with King Solomon's Mines because I fell in love with Deborah Carr and loved redheads, and that proved to be a problem later in life. But Gene Simmons she was so beautiful. And she had married Stuart Granger from King Solomon's Mines.
There you go. That's right. Yes, the circle is complete.
Yes. But I mean, the whole scene at the end where she's holding up the baby, he's free, Spartacus, he's free. I mean, it really tore me up as a kid. I thought, such a wonderful story.
Yeah. I love that one. Did you ever, have you seen the kind of the longer version, the restored version that they did with?
No, I haven't. With Kubrick, a lot more of his stuff was in the March and
it's
the
not too much. How much more?
It's that there were some things that they took out because they.
Oh yes, I saw the thing that Tony Hopkins. I saw the thing
with Tony Hopkins.
Tony Hopkins did Olivier's voice. You know, clams or oysters. Or
yes.
I saw that scene.
Is that's the old script? Because Anthony Hopkins sounds exactly like Laurence Olivier, but Tony Curtis sounds nothing like Tony Curtis.
Tony is a great mimic.
But it's wonderful, wonderful.
We'd like to pause here a minute to thank our sponsor. We have a sponsor, moviesunlimited.com, the movie collector's website. They're not only big fans of our show, but they feature many of the movies we talk about here, and so you can easily find them and add them to your collection. Sure, you can stream a lot of stuff these days, but when you buy your favorites, you watch what you want to watch and when you want to watch it. And there's always a ton of great content and bonus features like director commentaries, deleted scenes, and stuff like that.
Yep, that's right, Joe. They are the best. You're going to find classics, imports, hard-to-find films, and, of course, new releases as well. Pretty much everything Bruce is talking about this week and our other guests on previous episodes, their prices are great. Their choices are endless. So you can own the titles you love, like hold them in your hands and enjoy all the bonus features you just don't get with streaming. So click on the Movies Unlimited banner on the Trailers from Hell website. Or you can go to Movies Unlimited and you can click on the Movies That Made Me website. It'll take you to all of our episodes. There's links to every movie that's mentioned on every episode. They're just the best. They're a movie collector's website. Shipping is always free on orders over $50. So let's get back to Bruce Davidson and let's find out what's the next movie that made him.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Psycho.
Yeah.
That was Wildwood, New Jersey, too. I got
what a place. Yes,
perfect. Let me in, and it really scared the hell out of me. And I thought it was so great. And, you know, I started, you know, imitating Tony Perkins. I mean, you can see shades of it in Willard, even if you look.
Oh, yeah.
Tony Perkins in that and all of that. That really scared me. And then I was asleep, and my mother unfortunately left my friend Billy Rumig wake me up the next morning. And of course he came in and he went, wee, 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 wee. And I've never been the same ever since.
were you fortunate enough to have seen it before anybody spoiled it? Like early? Or?
Yes. I didn't know anything about it. We were there the first night. You can't come in after the first hour, a half hour. Nobody will. I mean, they'll never.
Like first 5 minutes or something. I think. Yeah.
So
very good about not spoiling that movie. Actually.
Yeah.
Because that was the whole advertising gimmick you know, he's
right.
Big blow ups of Hitchcock pointing at his watch and saying, you know, you can't come in. And, you know, which was then ripped off by William Castle and everybody else.
Well, I was going to say, and I saw all the Castle films and all of that stuff and George Pal space stuff and Planets Exploding. They were all great movies to me, but these are movies that I can say changed for better or worse.
No, that's one of those movies that just you wish, because I think even by the time I saw it as a kid. We knew what was coming. You didn't. Right.
Now the next one, I just was starting to hit college in. So I hit college and saw Dr. Zhivago after Lawrence of Arabia. I love Lawrence of Arabia, but Dr. Zhivago was so romantic, and it was so, you know, the snow. And I was going to school at NYU, and we lived. The school was on 7th Street, which was a Russian neighborhood, and it was snow, and I'd be, you know, going to class going, and I just loved the romance of that movie. So that was
it's interesting, because most people I think would pick Lawrence.
Yeah, but Julie Christie isn't in Lawrence.
That's
I loved Lawrence of Arabia. I thought it was great, and it was, you know, certainly watching Peter O'Toole's performance, you know, it's like a bed with clean sheets. And it's for the boy. You know, I love that. And I got to be friends years later with Robert Bolt and got to know him. And he said his two greatest images were the simplest ones on film. The first one was in Lawrence, where he says, the trick is not minding, and he puts out the flame, and then suddenly there's the sun that could not be put out. That light.
I got glared at an academy screening several years back when it was the head of the academy. They were introducing Lawrence, and talking about all the amazing, and basically giving David Lean credit for the dialogue even. And I shouted out, "Robert Bolt!
And his
got a glare from the stage, but a few people clapping in the audience. So.
And the other one he loved was in Dr. Zhivago, where you're just seeing this slaughter happen in the eyes of Omar Sharif, and you don't see anything. And then he looks down and there's a puddle of blood in the snow. Mm. And he said, for me, that was the Russian Revolution.
Yeah. Yeah.
In one simple shot. And I always remember that as filmmakers and stuff years later, if you could pare it down to the simplicity of what you're telling in a simple shot,
Well, there's a, I'm sure we've talked about it too. Have you seen the Russian version of War and Peace, the 7.5 hour one?
No, I haven't.
Highly, highly recommend. It's from 1966, Joe. And I just saw it a couple of years ago and won't shut up about it. But
it's been restored recently.
Yeah, they've done a restoration of it. And of course, they had, you know, the Soviet government would just take anything you need. And, you know, they have essentially about $1 billion budget to make this movie with these massive epic battle scenes. It's the biggest movie you've ever seen, but probably the most impactful shot in the whole thing is a slow, slow, slow push in on an actress as one tear comes down her face. It's just devastating. And it's, I think, always important to remember.
We tried to capture and everything from when he was doing The Elephant Man. Anyway, by that time in college, I got to a place called the 12 Trees Cinema, which...
You mentioned that, yes.
Yeah, a friend of mine who would run, and there I started to see the films that really changed me, that that were impactful as foreign films. The first was La Strada. Mm. And I got to see that. And that, you know, these are the kind of movies that you walk out of and you're changed having witnessed them. And I got to
Was that your first foreign film or your first kind of foreign
film? No, I saw a couple of others, you know, but
that was the one.
That was the first one that had the greatest impact on me. You know, there was a lot of the French New Wave stuff happening and stuff. And, you know, that was all great. And Shoot the Piano Player and all of that. But that was the first one that hit me. Mm-hmm. And I got to talk to Quinn. I worked with Anthony Quinn. We did two films later. And I said, that incredible scene at the end where you look up, the regret comes into your life. He says, there was no regret. Nothing to do with regret. I was looking up at the stars and I thought of myself as so meaningless in the infinity of it all. I felt so small, and that's what that was about. And I thought, okay, well, I've got something also for that, you know. So that was great. And then I got to see Amarcord too, which I think was my favorite Fellini film.
And people don't talk about that one enough. I feel like
it was just it was Fellini at his most juvenile, and you could see where all the characters and all the grotesqueries started to come from. The accord, the blind accordion player, and Venus, the whore that mount the docks, and the, you know, the pomposity of the characters. And they were all real. They were all the real people that he grew up with, that he knew, you know, civil play, the beautiful, a great, unattainable woman, you know, that can only be conquered by, you know, Mussolini fascist soldiers that come in and stuff. And he just captured so much of it. And I loved the fact that it was always moving. It was like a parade, the whole a parade into what would become his future. I just loved that film.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. Again, for some reason, I mean, because there are weak Fellini films, and you understand why they're not talked about, and they're the great ones. But I feel like, Joe, why does Amarcord get a short shrift?
Because I did the trailer.
It's Joe's fault. It's Joe's fault, people.
Oh, really?
Was that one that's one that Corman?
Roger was releasing pictures by then. And by then, the foreign films were being dumped by the major studios. They didn't want anything to do with them anymore. And so Roger picked them all up, and he started putting out Fellini and Truffaut.
That's one thing I regret, that I wasn't on the ground floor with all you guys with Roger Corman. I got to
be. Well, you were already well established before.
That's why I didn't get to learn what the hell I was doing. You know, I got thrown into a couple of pictures as leads. And I just working off of my instincts. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. You know, I had no clue.
Well, you learn by doing.
Well, you learn by doing, but I wish I'd learned more before I started doing.
I think you did pretty well.
Yeah, you did pretty well for a guy who's.
Oh, yeah. But
anyway. So Joe's, it's Joe's fault. I'm fascinated by that.
Actually, it was a very successful picture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so many of you that started with him that just were great. I used to meet him over a fellow named Beach Dickerson's house.
Oh, yeah. Beach used to be in all of his pictures, and he would put on his, he would also put on his porch and things. I mean, Beach right. was a yeah. jack of all trades.
He was. Beach Dickerson, yes, he was. He couldn't never collect, but just had more Hollywood stories.
Of oh, the God, he knew all the
Hollywood than anybody I've ever met.
He buried some of them.
Yes, he did. He buried most of them.
I shouldn't be hearing any of this.
Anyway, next one I saw was 400 Blows, and that just blew me away, especially that you could do that on the fly with the camera work and stuff. And I got to work by 1972, getting into the film, and I started being successful then, and I got to work with Raoul Coutard, who was the cameraman on that. And what a wonderful cameraman, because he could shoot by the seat of his pants. And it was all about that new wave French movement where they could just shoot on the street and throw an eclair on your shoulder and walk down. Or I was shooting in Jerusalem, and we'd walk into this old Arab's hut of a house, and he'd get some tin foil and a flashlight and stick it up in the corner there and just arrange the lights and shoot and boom. And the director would be fussing, and he says, it's not about the sun coming in. It's about the actors getting in the door. We are losing the sun. Get, shoot, shoot, shoot. And we shot. Okay, what's the next shot? So I loved Coutard working like that. And I got to work with Truffaut. Well, I didn't get to work with him, our old friend, Stephen. We were neighbors and friends back in the early days. When he was shooting Close Encounters, Steven Spielberg. And he was explaining to Robert Bolton in the hot tub one night what he was going to do. And he'd said, I'm going to make a movie that nobody's ever seen before. And we all said, okay, Steven, good luck with that. And he's been doing it every picture ever since. So,
I want more Robert Bolton, the hot tub stories.
That's, oh, yeah. So, yeah. I said, Stephen, what are all these triangles and what's the mothership and what is that? And he's trying to explain it. And Robert Bolton said, well, it sounds very interesting. And he's got Truffaut in that. And I flew down. I'm one of the extras that walks off the mothership. But I just, I think I just done Willard or something, and he couldn't use me as anything more than a shadowy extra, or it would blow a tire out of the end.
Right. Oh, that's fantastic.
So I'm the fourth pilot over on the shadow of the four pilots that walk out. The other three.
Now, if we know what to look for, can we tell it's you, or are you just completely shadowed?
Well, I don't know. You probably could. You could probably tell it's me if you stopped the frame now that you could do nowadays. But I had the hat on and everything else, and the other three were the writers.
Did you know that joke? No.
But I got to fly down, and I was on my way to do Short Eyes, I think. I think I was on my way to fly to New York to do Short Eyes. And he said, stop off at Mobile and, be an extra. So I came in, and I got to have dinner with him and Truffaut. And Truffaut was having a cigar, and he said, you want one? I said, yeah, okay. So I took a cigar and I lit it up and nearly choked for a minute. Then I let it go out and I kept it for years in a plastic bag till it all disintegrated. I was so sorry that I didn't get it and put it in plexiglass, But anyway, that was true.
Great. That's great.
Another film?
Okay. Yeah.
Paths of Glory.
Oh.
I think the last 10 minutes of Paths of Glory is the greatest anti-war statement ever committed to film. And anybody who can see it, it is just riveting. And kudos to Kirk Douglas for putting that together at the time. Also, Kirk Douglas, the man who gave Dalton Trumbo credit after the blacklisting for Spartacus. But the last 10 minutes of that are just change will change you forever if you've never seen it.
I had a friend who said that he was very grateful that at the end of the picture, Kubrick shows all the cast members.
Yes.
And he said, it's to give you a chance to dry your tears before you have to leave
the theater. Not actually dead. Yeah. And the great credit going to the woman that was his wife, mm-hmm. who played the singer on stage as all these hardened, battle-scarred warriors, throw things at the woman up there who's the little gem washed up from the enemy's shore. And I can hear somebody's, say Kirk Douglas's last line when they say, we're called back up to the front. He said, give them a minute. Great film.
Yeah, it is. And it's something, it gets called out in the movie Stuntman, but something sort of noticed before that so many war movies, even if they're made with the best intentions, somehow end up inadvertently kind of glamorizing the experience. Yeah. There's a line in the Stuntman, I remember, where he talks about a friend of his making his great anti-war statement, and then the week it plays in his hometown, enlistment goes up 100%. Yeah. But I've also had, like, that's one of the few films that you can't walk out of Paths of Glory and go, I'm going to go join the army. Yeah. It just doesn't do that.
Well, once again, it's not about the spectacle of blowing things up or carnage or any of that. It's
or the heroism,
the soul and the decimation of a single, scarred, cragged face with a tear running down its face, his face. And, not to take it away from all the other great war movies, but that for me is, that's the blood in the snow.
Yeah. Great.
Then one last film is a more recent one that I did that changed me was 12 Years a Slave. But 12 Years a Slave really just got me as a person to the point where it was just no longer avoidable who we are and what we have to, the heart and soul of America and the great scar that runs down our middle. And that movie changed me as well. So
it's an amazing film.
It's a great movie, and it's unfortunately can't be taught in school.
No, you can't teach it.
We don't talk about that stuff.
No, we don't. Yeah, it's you don't want to feel guilty about it, but shit, you better know who you are. History, as they say, is repeated when one doesn't learn the lessons of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, those are my films.
Oh wow, that's a great selection there, Bruce.
It's a great list, and also you practically took me through my entire childhood, since I guess we're pretty close to the same age. I saw all the same pictures in the 50s.
Well, we could go back and do all the subcategories too, I'm sure, Joe, because you are a master. I mean, I like to be in a room playing poker with you and Scorsese and Spielberg. All of you are just the film historians that know every film. I'm working with a fellow named Spencer Green now, who's kind of like that too. He knows everything. He's helping me write some stories from a book of stories, real stories that people that I've learned from.
Is this a forthcoming tome from you?
Pardon?
Is this a forthcoming book from you?
Well, it's forthcoming. I don't know if it'll ever be done, but or I'll be dead and he'll finish it because he's a kid. But he's a, a Leonard Maltin introduced me. So
work for Leonard's one of those guys too.
Oh yeah, yeah, Leonard's one of us. He can join the poker game along with Quinn and all those other people.
Good.
Yeah, it's one of the things I learned very coming here from Philadelphia, where you know back in Philly, I was that kid. You know, I knew everything. I was the human encyclopedia of film. And you come here to LA, and you're like, I'm going to show these people. And then you know, 10 minutes after you get off the bus, you meet someone like Joe Dante, and you're like, oh, Jesus, I don't know
anything. There's no point in being a human encyclopedia anymore now that we've got IMDb.
Yes.
All you have to do is look it up, you know.
But we had to
carry all that stuff around in our heads.
I know.
The wonderful thing are the experience I've had with some of the great people hands-on, one after another, like Bert or Henry Fonda or Lucille Ball, things that, you know, you can't learn except sitting there in the makeup chair or, you know, having a drink after an 18-hour day or, you know, stuff like that, that are just, that's, for me, has been just the best advice and things I've ever had from people.
Who was the first movie star you walked into to work with? The first time you found yourself standing in front of a camera with a movie star. Do you remember who that?
Well, I guess that would have to be Bert.
Bert.
Because that was my third film. Or Ernie Borgnine. Yeah. Working with Ernie. Ernie was great. And he was great. I asked him what the best advice he could give me was. He says, never go to bed angry at your wife. Get up and talk.
That is great advice.
For 2, 3 days, 4 days. I said, that didn't work out so well with Ethel Merman, though. Did it? Oh, no.
Wait, did you say that?
Yeah. I was, smart-ass, arrogant kid. I'd say anything.
How could it work out with Ethel Merman?
Come into my mind, you know, I challenged Bert and he'd say, you're a hell of an actor, goes without saying, you don't use rehearsal time properly, you try to get the performance of the sound, and you give another performance, man laying the marks over there, you certainly give a performance for all those girl extras, comes time to your close-up, you've shot your wad. Like making love to a woman or whoever you may make love to, I don't know. You can't try to have that orgasm all at once. You have to have foreplay.
Although, guys, I think Borgnine's
shot, the over-the-shoulder shot, you save it for the close-up.
I feel like Borgnine's advice is probably the most useful. Well, that's
Borgnine was such a nice guy. I mean, I only worked with him once, but he was a fountain of stories and just so gregarious.
He was the sweetest man, and he had the greatest story. He loved everybody except that guy Joey, who he did the movie, the TV series with, McHale's Navy. Joey,
Joey Flynn.
Yeah, he didn't like him.
He didn't like.
Oh
Joe
no,
Flynn.
No, why not? I've always been fascinated by Joe Flynn.
Said he tried to stab him with a samurai sword or something one time.
Oh, that would be a reason not to.
My God, Joe, what did you work with him on? I should know this.
Joe Flynn?
Joe worked with Borgnine.
He was one of the voices of the small soldiers.
Oh, okay, great. Oh, yeah, no, of course he's.
Because we hired the cast of the Dirty Dozen to play the.
Oh God,
the soldiers.
Lee Marvin,
right, of course.
Oh boy.
Yeah, well, we couldn't hire Lee because he wasn't around. But
a great Lee Marvin story. I don't know. You guys are running out of time, though.
No.
Always time for a Lee Marvin story.
Yes, always time for a Lee Marvin.
Okay. Well, I'm at shooting a movie with Cassavetes in Munich called The Brass Target. And Cassavetes, a whole raft of, you know, Sophia Loren and Max von Sydow and George Kennedy playing Patton. Germans, the Russians could shove it up their ass, you know. And there's another movie shooting there, and Lee Marvin is doing somebody's Express or something like that. It was another big
Avalanche Express. Oh, good God, yeah. Very good.
We're all staying at the Arabella, and Joe Namath and all of them were in that. And who was that? God, I'm getting so senior momenty. Jaws.
Robert Shaw.
So anyway, and Robert Shaw was shooting the other lead with Lee Marvin. Anyway, they had this party. It was Oktoberfest. everybody was drunk out of their minds. It was like the first scene from Das Boot, you know, people sliding around
in the party, right?
Drinking. And of the two film companies all together, and everybody was there. And one actor got up, had two bottles of Dom Perignon, tried to get attention and smashed them together. They were all over his chest. And I'm just thinking, and I'd stopped drinking. I just stopped drinking. And Cassavetes was pissed at me for that because I wouldn't hang with him until 3 a.m. And I'm at this party, you know, talk about, you know, just the fifth wheel walking around this place thinking, what the hell am I going to do? And over in the corner there is sitting Lee Marvin having a ginger ale all by himself. And I walk over and I sit down. He says, yeah, sit down. You're not drinking. He says, no, I'm getting ready for my palimony case I got coming up. So I said, I'm not drinking either. He says, well, that's good. So let's, why don't we have a meeting? I said, okay. Then we started talking and we started talking about alcoholic fathers. And I was talking about my father. And I said, my father came back from the war. He was, you know, he was shattered. He was just, but he was always a pleasant, mellow drunk that was always falling in the lake or falling down the steps and then explaining himself, I fell in the lake, you know, obvious stuff like that. And he looked at me and he said, well, you're very lucky. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, my father wasn't like that when he drank. And I said, really? And then I said, what was the worst experience? He said, well, it was probably him when he knocked my tooth out and kicked me down the basement steps and I fell head over heels down the bottom of the steps and I'm holding my hand and up to my mouth as blood is coming out of it. And I say, what do I have to do to make you love me? And he said, fucking die. That was the worst. And that's where Lee Marvin came from.
Wow.
And I never saw him again. I never saw him after that. We never ran into each other again, but I just remembered poor Lee Marvin. And that's where he came from. That's where that Marine came from.
Mm.
Anyway.
Wow. Yikes. Well, that's a hell of a story.
Yeah.
Well, Bruce, thank you.
Thank you for cheering us up.
Yeah, thanks for going out on a high note.
I'm sure I got a happier one, but I couldn't.
But no, this has been wonderful.
No, it's great.
It's such a pleasure.
And you should stay in touch now that I've got your numbers and stuff.
Oh, please do, Joe. I would love to, you know, sit down and just chew the fat with you anytime. I mean, you always had such wonderful wisdom, and you know, you were an encyclopedia of our business.
I've forgotten walking, more than I remember, but
you're the like walking world book. You really are.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
And thank you, Josh. It's been a pleasure too. I didn't mean to leave you out.
Oh, no, that's all right. I'm absolute pleasure to meet you. Our show was recorded from several well-stocked bunkers. We can't wait to get back to beautiful downtown Burbank. We're the official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me. Stay safe out there, folks.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.